Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For a long time, journalist and author Rick Bragg didn't want to talk about his father. His mother, yes, in his bestseller All Over But the Shoutin'. His sainted Southern grandfather, yes, in Ava's Man. But his father, a proud, mean, too often drunk man, no, until now. The devil lives in Alabama, he writes in his latest memoir, and swims in a mason jar. In The Prince of Frogtown, Bragg paints a picture of a hard, complicated, and ultimately tragic figure. He looks at his own fathering instincts and the history and lore of his hometown of Jacksonville, Alabama. This hour, On Point, Rick Bragg on fathers, sons, and the South. Joining me now from Mobile, Alabama is Rick Bragg. He's an award-winning journalist who currently teaches at the University of Alabama. He won the Pulitzer Prize in 1996 for his work at the New York Times and twice received a Distinguished Writing Award from the American Society of Newspaper Editors. His latest in a series of Southern memoirs just out is The Prince of Frogtown. Rick Bragg, welcome to On Point.
No, my pleasure.
It's great to have you. Your father stood behind everything you've written so far, but you never really put the spotlight on him. Now you have. Why now, Rick?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. I guess the one good reason was I was afraid I'd die and wind up in hell with him and have to explain myself. Little afraid of that. Wanted to give him his say. And the other reason was I thought I'd pretty much handled it and put it aside in what little bit I'd written about him in All Over But the Shoutin'. And then about 4 years ago, got married and inherited a boy of my own. And it makes a lot of sense to people who have kids, but I didn't think that when I got a boy that I would think about my own father all the time. And that's what happened.
Inherited a boy of your own, as in a 10-year-old who came
right.
with your new once married already wife, who you describe in very attractive terms, Rick. But the complications of fathering, sudden fathering, turning your mind back there, were you worried that you might be an incarnation of your dad, who was a very tough father to have?
It kept me away from even thinking about a real family for a long time. And there is that fear that you'll turn out just like him. You know, that the weaknesses and the foibles will, you know, really are inherent.
You famously write so beautifully, it just about makes a person cry. But I wish you'd begin to read just a little bit for us from the book on page 7. And this is not where your dad is in full lather and mean as he can be, and he can be awfully mean. But just men of his time and place standing around, and a wonderful kind of description there. I wish you'd share some of that with us, Rick.
Oh, sure. This paragraph is how I wanted him to be. You know, how we all... you know, wanted, I think, a father to be.
Mm-hmm.
The men segregated themselves under the chinaberry tree. They wore double-knit slacks and what we called sport shirts, not one necktie or day of college between them, but capable men who fixed their own cars, patched their own water lines, and laid their own bricks. They were a mix of the old and new South, men who drew their paychecks from the cotton mills, pipe shops, and steel mills, but still believed that you could make it rain if you hung dead snakes in the branches of trees. They were solid as the steel they rolled or the concrete they poured. They did not drink, did not cuss unless they were in the fraternity of like-minded men, and surrendered their paychecks to their wives the minute they walked in the front door. As they talked, they clicked chrome Zippo lighters toward thin, tight, hand-rolled cigarettes and stuffed strings of tobacco into their jaws until they looked deformed. Some were saved, some backslid, and some as yet unaffiliated. But even the ones who walked in the holy holy did not preach to the others out of respect. If you went to work and fed your babies, you were already halfway home. So they spoke of the secular, of the secrets of fuel injection. how to put brake shoes on a 64 Corvair, or the best way to worm a good dog. They believed in General Motors, Briggs & Stratton, Craftsman, Poulan, John Deere, International, Tree Brand, Zebco, Remington, and Wolverine, and the bumper stickers on their trucks read Wallace, or nothing at all.
Rick Bragg, reading from his new memoir, the third in a cycle, I guess, and maybe the last in that cycle, we'll ask him, The Prince of Frogtown, the latest. You say right there, Rick, that your father was, in that moment, this sort of snapshot in your mind's eye, one of those men, like and yet unlike them. How?
Well, he was darker. He had gone off across an ocean and killed a man by holding his head under a stream of water. This was in the dying days of Korea. And he grew up in a house where there was a can of white whiskey on the dining room table every day of the weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, all his life, and drank early and a lot. And that stuff was kind of like heroin. It got a hold of you, and it never let you go. So he was just darker, a little bit meaner. He was a fighter and a risk taker, and he was only happy if he was in conflict and kind of in battle.
Anybody who's read All Over But the Shoutin' and some of Ava's Man, a couple of your earlier books, will know some of the impact that character had on your family. But I wish you'd share a bit just so people have context for understanding the father you describe in much more detail here. How did it play out for your family, that dark side of your dad?
Well, I was only with him probably a few months of my life. He came in and out of our lives every couple of years, and he would stay a few months, and then he would disappear again. And as I got old enough to see what was happening, it was always violent, and it was always scary. And my mother absorbed it, you know, protected us from it, and wasted her beauty and her youth, you know, standing in line for commodity cheese and picking cotton, scrubbing up other people's floors, took in laundry, did all those things, you know, so that I'd have a chance to sit here and do this one day. And basically was a mother and father and everything else. But she also had to survive him and his demons. And we left him when I was six put our clothes in brown paper sacks and walked down a railroad track, and that was it. And but she sentenced herself to, you know, to a life of being a maid and you know, doing things that I wish she could have been spared. And that's the, you know, again, she absorbed most of it, the hard part.
How did you set out then with that little exposure, not even a year in total maybe, though plenty of exposure to the impact of him, how did you set out to fill out the picture of this man, your dad, Charles Bragg?
Well, first you beg your mother to tell you some stories, and it, you know, it took her about a year to really. I began with one simple question. Tell me one good story about my daddy. It took a long time. And then when I finally, actually before I even got that story from her, because she would say things like, you know, she wouldn't tell me no. She'd just say, did you hear I got a raise on my Social Security? Or did you hear that, you know, a snake fell through a hole in your Aunt Juanita's roof and almost landed in the lap of your Uncle Ed? She'd tell me any story to not talk about him. But eventually she did. And I also had to knock on a lot of doors. And I found his playmate when he was 5 years old. I found a little boy who fist fought him in the mill village for membership in a gang of little boys. You know, an old man now, an old woman now. Found his best friend when he was a teenager. And every now and then someone would just walk up and tell you a story. And that's where it came from.
But this is not, and we'll look at it, this is not ultimately a story about forgiveness, not even exactly quite about coming to terms with your father.
No, I think, you know, writers and I think readers too sometimes want stories to be pat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, I think, the beauty of a novel is that you can make it pat. You know, when you flip that last page and snap that book closed, the monster is well and truly dead. You know that. But in a real life story, it's not pat. And you don't forgive him for all the things that happen, and you don't forgive any of that, or at least most of it. But what you have after 200, 300 pages is something else to think about. You've got a story an old man told me about him and his, about the two of them when they were boys lying in a field flying a kite. And had so much cord that the kite went completely out of sight. And the little boy came up and demanded to know what was going on because all that he saw was a string disappearing into heaven. My father told him he was fishing for the man in the moon. You have things like that.
There's a good moment. There are some bad ones. Plenty. Rick Bragg's new book is The Prince of Frogtown. He joins us from Mobile, Alabama. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Rick Bragg about the third and maybe last in his series of Southern family memoirs. This one goes at his hard-drinking, bare-knuckled father, Charles Bragg. It's called The Prince of Frogtown. And Rick, plenty of people already want to speak to you. Sherry, in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air with Rick Bragg.
Yeah, I'm in the middle of reading Ava's Man. I just finished All Over But the Shoutin', and I'm back. I've got The Prince of Frogtown, and I just wanted to say I thoroughly enjoy reading Rick Bragg books. They're just marvelous, and they're heartbreaking at the same time, as you can only imagine. And Rick Bragg, I was wondering about forgiveness and your dad. Can you and will you and have you completely forgiven him?
No, I don't. Thank you. First of all, thank you very much. I don't think that will ever happen. I think what does happen is that as we kind of were talking about earlier, you have more to think about when you think about him, when you go back and you ask people to talk about him. There are too many things to be mad about, quite frankly. We like to joke in my family that, you know, we can hang on to a bad feeling for a very, very long time. But I don't think I ever will. But I do know this. There was good in him. I know that now. And I know that he meant a lot to a lot of people. And that has to be worth something.
You write in here that this is the man you wrote of in your early 30s. That is when All Over With the Shoutin' was written. I summed him up as a tragic figure, a one-dimensional villain whose fists and tongue lashed my mother when he was drunk, who drove us away for months and years, only to reclaim us again when we crossed his mind against his darkness. Her light was even brighter as she just absorbed his cruelties till she could not take them into herself anymore. Beautiful as always. And you've got a statement right there where you say this, maybe this closes this cycle of family stories you're telling. And you explain a little bit on page 13 of what you're up to in that closing. And if it's not forgiveness, there is a kind of understanding, even with still a hard edge to it. I wonder if you could just read us. It's kind of a mission statement there near the beginning of your book, Rick.
Sure. I think this sums it up, I guess, better than anything I could ever come up with again. In this book, I close the circle of family stories in which my father occupied only a few pages, but lived between every line. In my first book, I tried to honor my mother for raising me in the deprivations he caused. In my second, I built from the mud up the maternal grandfather and folk hero who protected my mother from my father, but died before I was born, leaving us to him. In this last book, I do not rewrite my father or whitewash him. But over a lifetime, I've known a lot of men in prisons, men who will spend their eternity paying for their worst minute on earth. It came when they caught their wife cheating on them and thumbed back the hammer on a gun they bought to shoot rats and snakes, or got cross-eyed drunk in some fish camp bar and pulled out a dime store knife just because they imagined a funny look or a suspicious smile. You do not have to forgive such men, ever, that minute. You can lock them away for it, put them to death for it, and spend your eternity cursing their name. It is not all they are.
Rick Bragg again, reading from The Prince of Frogtown. There's a context for this story and for the man that your father was, and it's poor, and it's industrial, mill-related, and it's Southern. It's easy to see him as a stereotype or an archetype or something in that world. How do you look at, you know, this will not be an unknown kind of character to Americans who have read or lived that region. Do you worry about sliding over into stereotype there? And where does he fit in the kind of iconography of Southern men?
Well, I think a lot of the times stereotypes become stereotypes because they're just dirt common. There are just so many. And so many men like him. Like there were so many women like my mom, you know, standing with a baby on their hip doing the best they could. What you try to do is not fall into cliches, and you try not to fall into stereotype. You try to write specifically about who he was and what he was. You try to write specifically about his battles and his feuds. For instance, his feud with our town police chief ran for years, and you try to explain it, explain why the police chief had to stake him down with a length of chain to the foot of College Hill so the whole town could see him, and why, you know, that burned my father's insides out. I think these men have been written about. I think they've been written about a lot. One of the differences is that this man was flesh and blood, and he mm-hmm. walked around among us, and he was not pulled from someone's imagination.
You say so many like him. Why? And I guess when you mean that, you mean too much anger, too much drink, too much violence. And in our national literature, and no small experience in a Southern setting, why?
Right. Well, part of it is just class. These men have always kind of been foot soldiers in one battle or another. You know, if my father had been born 100 years before, he would have probably, you know, suffered through dysentery in a Confederate camp and fought barefoot, you know, for some rich man's war. You know, these men are there are a lot of them, and they, you know, they began with kind of one foot in the grave, and some of them work their way out of it. They're tough, and they're pretty smart, and they're cunning, and they work their way out of it, and they become great, decent men. Become great men. And some of them give in to the bitterness and the resentment and the hatred and that class struggle and the whiskey. And the whiskey is kind of like the lubrication that helps them slide downhill. And there were a lot of them out there. That's one reason why when we do a book signing, you won't have a dozen people. You'll have 100 people, say, if there are more than 100 there, who will come up and say, "That was my daddy," or "You stole my story."
Let's take a call from Wellesley Island, New York. Joe, you're on the air with Rick Bragg.
Hello, Rick. I wanted to check in and say hello to you and let you know how much I've enjoyed your writing over the years. A few years back, I started using Oliver But the Shouting in my sixth grade literature class.
Oh, thank you.
With a little guidance from me in terms of helping them figure out some of the more sophisticated sort of images and metaphors and so on, they enjoy it immensely, especially the parts early in the book where you are around the same age that they are. And it gives them a real, I think, useful and clear look at a life that they're not too familiar with. The 50s is ancient history to them, of course. Mm-hmm. And I always have some of my better readers after the unit is over come to me, ask me to get them a copy of the book, where can they get it, and so on. And I suspect it's rewarding to hear that your work reaches even into those areas of the culture.
Joe, what do your young students say about the way Rick Bragg's father treated Bragg's mother?
Well, some of my kids, of course, have gone through, don't have fathers at home and so on, but they admire the picture in that book, the image of the mom struggling to bring up the three boys. As they had just seen out of life, they recognize the difficulty of his alcohol abuse and so on, and I discuss that in an age-appropriate way with them and how it might affect the family and what might have driven. I highlight the point of the book where Rick talks a little bit about suspecting that his father was damaged as a result of his war experiences, and we discussed that some. So these kids are at the age where they're just beginning to sort of sort out and wonder about sort of wider issues. It's more beyond their immediate experience. So,
Joe, we got a rough line, but we thank you for your call. Rick Bragg, what does it bring to mind when you think of sixth graders sitting around reading the work, the intimate details of your family? Plenty of adult readers out there. Sixth graders, are you ready to shape them with your family story?
Well, I was tickled to death when college age readers were trying to find something good in it. This is it makes me feel good. Makes me a little sad that some of them would recognize it, you know. But if you write anything, you want there to be some value in it. And if a sixth grader can look at it and see what I'm trying to say about my mom. I mean, Shouting was nothing more than a love story for her.
Mm-hmm.
And in some ways the region, but for her. If they see it and see something good in it, then you kind of won. And there's another thing, too, I think most authors would agree with me that, you know, when you're at a book signing and you look up and you see young people in line, it makes your heart sing because, you know, the cliche is it's hard to get young people to read. And when you look up and you see someone, you know, high school age or so, standing in line, unfortunately, invariably, they walk up and you say, "Teacher made you read it, huh?" They go, "Yeah." But I'll take it. Thank you.
But there was the 10-year-old in this book, the boy that came with new love on your part and a new woman in your life, was actually very hard for you to accept that generation of boy, the cut of boy he happened to be, part of what drove you back to look at your own father and look at yourself in the reflection. Do you have a problem with kids who didn't grow up, you know, drinking knee-high in 1959?
I think we all do. I think we're all wondering why they just can't, you know, be happy with a knee-high, you know.
Little grape soda down by the creek?
Yeah, how come a grape soda isn't good enough? You know, why does it have to be a latte? You know, the first time I ever saw like a 10 or 11-year-old order like a mochaccino latte or whatever they are, I just stood there flabbergasted and a little troubled. But I just didn't recognize boys who didn't grow up as I did.
You say he took
them.
Slippers for a car ride, and you write, "I didn't care if he rode bulls or danced ballet, and that's the truth. But what made me crazy was the idea that he was the kind of boy you used to despise, the kind who looked down his nose on the boy I was. My mother cleaned houses, you write, cooked for their houses, cooked for them, diapered them. I would not have a boy like that, and yet you maybe did."
Well, he was. I was afraid he was. Instead, what I got was just a little boy, you know, a boy who, when I was 10 years old, I helped my Uncle Ed break down truck tires with a sledgehammer. You know, I cleaned the tracks of bulldozers with a broken-handled shovel. That's not a sob story. That's just what we did. It was who we were. It was part of our life. And I'm sure that a lot of your listeners did things very much like that. You know, they worked the counter. They, you know, they did a lot of things. It's just what we did. I wanted my boy to be tougher. And, of course, that was foolish because he was plenty tough all along. He was just different. You know, he was just different. And it takes a long time to figure that out because I'm not that bright. And it took me a while. It took me a while to figure out that he was just different. But, yeah, I think you do want him to want to jump in a creek. You want him to want to, you know, mix it up in a fist fight. You want him to be able to really be able to throw a rock. And I don't know why that is. I guess it's just you want to see something of yourself in them, whether there's anything genetically of you in them or not.
Let's get a call from Cedartown, Georgia, and Bill. Bill, you're on the air with Rick Bragg.
Hey, Tom. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hey, Rick.
Hey.
Good to see you. Good to hear you, rather. I grew up in Jacksonville. I knew a lot of people you wrote about in your first book. We lived right down the street from Creasy Curry, the only girl who was pretty enough to ride in your car.
Yeah, the prettiest girl in town, yeah.
Well, she. I agree with you. I'm a good deal older than you, but I agree with you. In fact, I had occasion to talk to her a couple of years ago, and she said she thinks everybody she knows, everybody she doesn't know, has read that book and mentioned it to her. So you made her famous.
Immortalized as the prettiest girl in Jacksonville, Alabama.
That's exactly right, and I know where College Hill is.
Yeah.
Bill, what do you think about the kind of angry man that Rick Bragg describes, Southern man that Rick Bragg describes in his father?
Well, I think a lot of Southern men are that way. But on the other hand, a lot of Southern men aren't that way. You know, it's kind of a type that still exists, unfortunately.
Yes.
But at the same time, I think Rick said something about the stories, and I think when people are as poor as his folks were, poor but proud, as we say down here, that all that's left is the stories. You know, they have to get up and move out. The only thing they can take with them is their stories, their family legends, and that kind of thing. I think maybe that's one reason why the Southern people write so much.
Tell the story. It's what you've got.
Well, it's easier to move a book than it is to move a refrigerator, that's for sure.
Yeah, maybe so. Bill, our time is short before the break, but Rick, does poverty, you may explain it, but does it excuse it in your mind?
No, I don't. It's an excuse. You know, I'll always believe that it's, there's no excuse for what happened involving my dad, but I think it, if there is anything remotely, if there's a place to hide, that's as good a place as any, that poverty.
We'll be back with more of Rick Bragg and his latest book, The Prince of Frogtown. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author Rick Bragg about the third and maybe last in his series of Southern family memoirs. This one goes at his hard-drinking, bare-knuckled father, Charles Bragg. You can join the conversation. What's your comment, your question for Rick Bragg, author of All Over But the Shoutin', Ava's Man, and more? We're at 800-423-8255, 800-423-TALK. Rick Bragg joins us from Mobile, Alabama. And Rick, I'd be grateful if just to get more sense of your father, you might read a bit from page 22 there. You say he was not a marrying man.
Oh, yeah, he was.
Or wasn't to begin with, anyway.
Not at all. This is one of my favorite things to read because it's kind of shows you who he was. The old men laughed at him, all dooted up with that oil bucket in his hand. But the women loved his face. Even men so afraid of appearing feminine, they would walk a wide loop around the unmentionables in Sears to avoid being in proximity of a panty. would concede that, yeah, that Charles Bragg was a good-looking man. He had a movie star's squared-off chin with a dashing white line across it like a dueling scar. He got it one night drunk when he banged his face on the steering wheel, but it made him look mysterious and a little bit dangerous all the same. He had Indian blood and cheekbones proud and high, and his face tanned a dark red. His ears and Adam's apple were too big, but his hands were small and delicate as a woman's, yet strong as wire pliers, like his daddy's had been. He talked country but dressed for town, as all the boys from the mill village did back then. A hybrid hillbilly with silver dimes flashing in his black penny loafer shoes. He chain-smoked Pall Malls and toted a thin, yellow-handled knife in his left hip pocket so he could get at it quick. He hid a snub-nosed pistol at the small of his back, but only on weekends, and never when he was with her. He raised fighting dogs, bet on chickens, and loved vanilla ice cream. And I guess he was a scoundrel before he knew what a scoundrel was.
Rick Bragg from The Prince of Frogtown. You quote his cousin Carlos saying right there, he would cut you up if you hemmed him in. We've got folks, we have a new website up, and people can sending comments in on it. Rick, here's one from Suzanne in California. I'm at page 37 of your latest book. I had to stop because my eyes were already tearing up, something that doesn't happen to single mothers unless someone has hurt my child, and that hasn't happened for real since his daddy left us. And here you are about to go on radio, far away from where I am, me with Frogtown in my hands and a knot in my throat. My God, you're an amazingly gifted man. Kudos in from California. Let's take a call from Cindy in Methuen, Massachusetts. Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom and Rick. Thank you so much for talking about this subject. I only have one small issue in that it's not just a Southern gentleman. My grandmother used to talk about her father from England. She immigrated here in 1908, and she always talked about her father being a Johnny Bull, and about his I don't think she ever forgave him either.
Meaning he was hard physically on
her mother. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
They were the parents of 13 children, three of whom died in childbirth, but the rest lived to carry on the name. But she never spoke very much about her father, except to say that he was a very nasty man, and she wished her mother had had the courage to walk away. But I guess by the time her brothers were old enough, he sort of mellowed out because there was somebody stronger. But my biggest thing is, and this is mostly to Rick,
mm-hmm.
Do you see any solution to our young men still growing up to be hard-hitting, hard-drinking men, even though they see it in their own lives, how we can possibly stop this cycle? Because we hear about domestic violence all the time, and I'll be glad to get off the air and let you answer, but I'd love to know if you have any insight in that. Thank you so much.
Cindy, thanks. Yeah. Rick?
Well, I don't know about a solution. I do know that one of the things that I hope helped me be a decent man or a more decent one. I got plenty of flaws myself, but I was exposed early on to good men. You know, my uncles on my mama's side of the family were such good men. You know, they would have gnawed their own arm off before they would have done some of the things that happened. They were, you know, as I wrote in that paragraph earlier, they were the kind of men who did everything they could to take care of the people who depended on them, and were decent to them, and kind to them, and there was gentleness in them, even as they were about the hardest people you'd ever meet. These are the kind of people that'd be working on a car. The wrench will slip, and you know they'll peel 4 inches of skin off their arm, and you know they raise it up and look at the blood running down their arm. And they just go back to doing what they were doing. That's how tough they are. But there was a kindness and a gentleness in them, and there are all kind of Southern men and Northern men and Western men mm-hmm. and Eastern men who are that way. They pull in nets in the Pacific Northwest. They finish concrete out, in Vermont. There are lots of those good men, and I just, as much as you can get these young men exposed to them, it helped save me, I'm sure, being exposed to those good men early on. You have to see it, I think, sometimes before you know how to be it. But some young men don't have those people close to them. Mm.
Cindy, thanks for your call. Let's get one from Derry, New Hampshire, and Jim. Jim, you're on the air.
Hello, everyone. Hi, Rick. When I just read your first book recently, and it wasn't just a regional story to me. There was an awful lot about class in it. And,
right.
you got your Pulitzer, and you got your Harvard Fellowship, and you seemed to work really hard at holding on to your roots so that you could go back home again. And that struggle between when you're from a working-class family and you get a college education, but you still want to be able to go back home again. And it seems like the ivory tower sort of banishes an understanding of the working class for a lot of people. Could you just talk, since you've become a well-known author now and moved in those circles, do you see a lack of understanding sometimes in academia and, little too many people with pointy heads sort of walking around that lose the understanding of where they came from? And what's been your experience with that?
Yeah, I think lack of understanding might even be too kind a term. I think bald ignorance might be more appropriate. It is funny how fast some folks want to pretend that their working class life never happened. That they want to pretend that struggle, which is everything. I mean, what really does it mean if you start with everything and you wind up with everything? What really does that accomplish? If you start with nothing and you wind up with something, isn't that a much grander journey and something to be proud of? I never really will like trust fund babies very much. Can't help it, just won't like them. But I think you're absolutely right. The fact that it's a Southern book and that I'm a Southern writer is purely an accident of geography. This book could have been written in the Southwest. It could have been written in the Midwest. Could have been written anywhere. And it is more about class. I'm very proud of those people. Any time I do a talk, I ask the audience to everyone who is descended one generation, two generations, or three from people who worked with their hands, please raise your hand. And there may be a handful of people who don't raise their hand. And I figure they came over on the Mayflower. And there's a lot to be proud of in that. And to treat those people academically, and this happens a lot in government now, to treat them as numbers, as figures, or to ignore them is shameful.
John Edwards talked a lot about them, including mill workers, the kind of environment that stands behind your story here.
Mm-hmm. And if you look at how Edwards did at the polls, you see just how little a concern it seems to be on the minds of a lot of folks. The people that I don't want to say turned into heroes because they're certainly not, but the people that I admire most and the people I've been happiest to write about in my lifetime have been people who have been working class people, for lack of a better term, blue collar people. Blue collar jobs are, disappeared for a long time. They just vanished. And there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of concern. They don't seem to have many champions. They have a lot of rhetoric and they have a lot they have a lot of nice things said, but there don't seem to be many champions out there for these people.
Let's get a call from Charleston, South Carolina, and Megan. Megan, you're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I was just calling to relate my a story in our family. My husband has mother was married, and they had him, and she decided that the relationship with John just wasn't working out. She wasn't gonna, they weren't gonna do the thing she wanted for my husband and for her in their lifetime. And it turned out that John really wasn't the husband kind of type. And so she left when my husband was really young, and my husband was estranged from him for a real long time, and they really they talked sporadically. And recently, we have an 8-year-old daughter, and we got back in touch with John, and really have developed a nice relationship with him. He's a wonderful person. So glad he's in our life. But in Michael's mom will agree, you can't apply those definitions of husband or father or that sort of thing on him. You just take him for who he is, and it really has been nice to have him in our life, even though he wasn't the traditional father figure. And in fact, my husband now remarks on how similar he is, his life is, and the life he chose for himself to John's life. John's a machinist and has always worked for himself, and now my husband works for himself and owns a cabinet shop. And it's just nice, I think, that his mom recognized that John wasn't going to be able to provide what she wanted, and they split ways, and we've been able to reconnect with John and have a really nice relationship with him.
Yeah.
And
good for your family, but lucky for your family too, Megan, that the John who wasn't cut out to be a father also doesn't sound like he was abusive, violent. He wasn't a big negative in the family.
No, he just was, you know, he was his own person. He wasn't a husband, and he wasn't a stay-at-home kind of a father. But, boy, it's nice to have him around and have him contribute to our lives and be engaged in our daughter's life.
Lucky for you. Let me turn to Rick, if I may. Rick, your dad wasn't really the kind you could turn to have him swoop back into life later in that pleasant sort of way.
No, it was a different feel. You know, I like to think that if my father had lasted, if he had somehow lasted into old age, that I would spend time with him. I'd still be mad at him. But I know that I would go by, knowing what I know now, I know that I would spend time with him, and I would go sit with him, and I would talk to him and listen to his stories. Knowing what I know now, I would see some value in him and wish I had that chance.
I wanted to ask you where you are in your own life cycle as a writer. You've got these three memoirs out. Of course, you had the story of Jessica Lynch that you told in I'm a mm-hmm. Soldier Too. Mm-hmm. Very successful as a journalist with the New York Times, Pulitzer Prize and all that. Trouble back in 2002 when you had the article with the Dateline in the Apalachicola, Florida, that an intern had actually brought back for you and ended up leaving the Times over that. Are you finished with journalism? Are you finished with memoirs? Will you turn one day to fiction?
Oh, yeah, we'll do. I've done a lot of magazine stories. And as far as journalism goes, I've stayed in that and done cover stories for some national magazines and had a ball doing it. But I think that books are probably going to be my future because I think that's what you dream about when you first pick up a pen, is to make a living as a writer. And
who's your model? Is it Willie Morris? Is it Pat Conroy? Is it something else entirely?
Well, all those and a hundred others. Larry McMurtry writes some of my favorite books. Conroy, I've learned how to write about dysfunction by reading Conroy. I've, Willie Morris taught me how to write with a certain amount of, you hope, prettiness and elegance. And there are too many to even list because you learn from everybody you ever read. But we've got a contract with Knopf to do a novel. Not real sure what it's going to be about yet. I need to decide and getting started on that and hopefully write for the rest of my life. I'm not one of those people that I would love to take a break someday from writing because writing's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as hard as roofing, You know, it's not as hard.
It's not dead easy either.
Yeah, it's not dead easy. You know, it's not eating fried chicken for a living or you know, what was Little Abner, a mattress tester?
Right,
you know,
right.
You know, it's not that easy. But I'd really like to one day when someone asks me, you know, are you a writer? I'll say I have written, you know, and have a little time off writing stuff. But I love doing this stuff. I love my journalism life. I love doing it. But there's something wonderful about having 300 pages to tell a story.
And maybe free in the realm of fiction next time out. Rick Bragg's latest memoir, Last He Says in the Cycle, The Prince of Frogtown, about his father, Charles Bragg. Rick Bragg, a pleasure speaking with you today. Thank you very much for being with us.
No, Tom, it was my pleasure.
Rick Bragg with us there from Mobile, Alabama. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.